Some things needed testing. "I have watched the swamp dragons at night," Leonard said conversationally as Ponder Stibbons adjusted the static firing mechanism. "And it is clear to me that the flame is quite useful to them as a means of propulsion. In a sense, a swamp dragon is a living rocket. A strange creature to have come into being on a world like ours, I have always thought. I suspect they come from elsewhere." "They tend to explode a lot," said Ponder, standing back. The dragon in the steel cage watched him carefully. "Bad diet," said Leonard firmly. "Possibly not what they were used to. But I am sure the mixture I have devised is both nourishing and safe, and will have usable effect." But we will go and get behind the sandbags now, sir," said Ponder. Do you really think... Yes, sir... With his back firmly against the sandbags, Ponder shut his eyes and pulled the string. In front of the dragon's cage, a mirror swung down just for a moment, and the first reaction of a male swamp dragon on seeing another male is to flame. There was a roar. The two men peered over the barrier and saw a yellow-green lance of fire thundering out across the evening sea.
33 seconds, said Ponder when it finally winked out.
He leapt up. The small dragon belched. From the Journal of Leonard of Quirm, some observations on Draco vulgaris, common swamp dragon. "The creature's body shape is lumpy, its posture low and hopeless. Its beard and thrips are unkempt, and its scales almost non-existent. The dragon's wings are effectively useless, except in a glide, and its eggs badly constructed." The flame was more or less gone, so it was the dampest explosion Ponder had ever experienced. "Ah," said Leonard, arising from behind the sandbags and peeling a piece of scaly skin off his head. "Nearly there, I think. Just a pinch more charcoal and seaweed extract to prevent blowback." Ponder removed his hat. What he needed right now, he felt, was a bath. And then another bath.
"Not exactly a rocket wizard, am I?"
he said, wiping bits of dragon off his face. But an hour later, another flame lanced over the waves, thin and white, with a blue core, and this time... The dragon merely smiled.
"I'd rather die than sign my name," said Boy Willie.
"I'd rather face a dragon," said Caleb. "One of the proper old ones, too, not the little fireworky ones you get today."
"Once they get you signing your name, they've got you where they want you," said Cohen. "Too many letters," said Truckle. "All different shapes, too. I always put an X."
The horde had stopped for a breather and a smoke on an outcrop at the end of the Green Valley. Snow was thick on the ground, but the air was almost mild. Already there was the prickly sensation of a high magical field.
"Reading now," said Cohen. "That's another matter. I don't mind a man who does a bit of reading. Now, if you come across a map, as it might be, and it's got a big cross on it, well, a reading man can tell something from that."
"What, that it's Truckle's map?" said Boy Willie.
"Exactly. Could very well be."
"I can read and write," said Evil Harry. "Sorry, part of the job. Etiquette, too. You've got to be polite to people when you march them out on a plank over the shark tank. It makes it more evil."
"No one's blaming you, Harry," said Cohen.
"Huh. Not that I could get sharks," said Harry. "I should have known better when Johnny No-Hands told me they were sharks that hadn't grown all their fins yet, but all they did was swim around squeaking happily and start begging for fish. When I throw people into a torture tank, it's to be torn to bits, not to get in touch with their inner self and be one with the cosmos."
"Shark would be better than this fish," said Caleb, making a face.
"Nah, shark tastes like piss," said Cohen.
He sniffed.
Now that, said Truckle, "is what I call cookery."
They followed the smell through a maze of rocks to a cave. To the minstrel's amazement, each man drew his sword as they approached.
"You can't trust cookery," said Cohen,
apparently as an attempt at an explanation.
"But you've just been fighting monstrous mad devil fish," said the minstrel.
"Nah, the priests were mad. The fish were... well, hard to tell with fish. Anyway, you know where you stand with a mad priest, but someone cooking as well as that right up here, well, that's a mystery.
Well?
Mysteries get you killed.
You're not dead, though.
Cohen's sword swished through the air. The minstrel thought he heard it sizzle.
I solve mysteries, he said.
Oh, with your sword, like Carolinus untied the Tsortian knot.
Don't know anything about any knots, lad.
In a clear space among the rocks, a stew was cooking over a fire, and an elderly lady was working at her embroidery. It was not a scene the minstrel would have expected out here, even though the lady was somewhat youngly dressed for a grandmother, and the message on the sampler she was sewing, surrounded by little flowers, was, "Eat cold steel, pig dog."
"Well, well," said Cohen, sheathing his sword. "I thought I recognised the handiwork back there. How you doing, Fina?"
"You're looking well, Cohen," said the woman, as calmly as though she had been expecting them. "You boys want some stew?"
"Yeah," said Truckle, grinning. "Let the bard try it first, though."
"Shame on you, Truckle," said the woman, putting aside her embroidery.
"Well, you did drug me and steal a load of jewels off me last time we met."
"That was 40 years ago, man. Anyway, you left me alone to fight that band of goblins."
"I knew you'd beat the goblins, though."
"I knew you didn't need the jewels. Morning, Evil Harry. Hello, boys. Pull up a rock. Who's the thin streak of misery?"
This is the bard," said Cohen. "Bard, this is Vina, the raven-haired."
"What?" said the bard. "No, she's not. Even I've heard of Vina the raven-haired, and she's a tall young woman with..."
"Oh."
Vina sighed.
"Yeah, the old stories do hang around so, don't they?" she said, patting her grey hair. "And it's Mrs. McGarry now, boys."
"Yeah, I heard you'd settled down," said Cohen,
dipping the ladle into the stew and tasting it.
"Married an innkeeper, didn't you? Hung up your sword, had kids."
"Grandchildren?"
said Mrs. McGarry proudly. But then the proud smile faded.
"One of them's taken over the inn, but the other's a papermaker."
"Running an inn's a good trade," said Cohen. "But there's not much heroing in wholesale stationery. A paper cut's just not the same."
He smacked his lips.
"This is good stuff, girl."
"It's funny," said Vina. "I never knew I had the talent. But people will come miles for my dumplings."
"No change there, then," said Truckle the uncivil.
"Truckle," said Cohen, "remember when you told me to tell you when you were being too uncivil?"
"Yeah."
"That was one of those times."
"Anyway," said Mrs. McGarry, smiling sweetly at the blushing Truckle, "I was sitting around after Charlie died, and I thought, well, is this it? I've just got to wait for the Grim Reaper. And then there was this scroll."
"What scroll?" said Cohen and Evil Harry together. They stared at one another.
"You see," said Cohen, reaching into his pack, "I found this old scroll showing a map of how to get to the mountains and all the little tricks for getting past..."
"Me too," said Harry.
"You never told me."
"I'm a Dark Lord, Cohen," said Evil Harry patiently. "I'm not supposed to be Captain Helpful."
"Tell me where you found it, at least."
"Oh, in some ancient sealed tomb we was despoiling."
"I found mine in an old storeroom back in the Empire," said Cohen.
"Mine was left in the inn by a traveller all in black," said Mrs. McGarry.
In the silence, the minstrel said,
"Excuse me."
"What?"
said all three together.
"Is it just me," said the minstrel, "or are we missing something here?"
"Like what?"
demanded Cohen.
"Well, these scrolls all tell you how to get to the mountains, a perilous trek that no one has ever survived."
"Yeah, so?"
"So, who wrote the scrolls?"
A few of the Discworld gods were passing the time as they do. Gathered around a large playing board were Sesifet, goddess of the afternoon, Ofla, the crocodile-headed, Flatulus, god of the winds, Fate, Eureka, goddess of the saunas, snow, and theatrical performances for fewer than 120 people, Blind Io, chief of the gods and general thundering, Libertina, goddess of the sea, apple pie, certain types of ice cream and short lengths of string, The Lady, don't even ask, Bibulus, god of wine and things on sticks, Patina, goddess of wisdom,
Topaxi, god of certain mushrooms, and also of great ideas that you forgot to write down and will never remember again, and of people who tell other people that dog is god spelled backwards and think this is in some way revelatory. Bast, god of things left on the doorstep or half-digested under the bed, and Nuggan, a local god but also in charge of paperclips, correct things in the right place in small desk stationery sets, and unnecessary paperwork. Offler the crocodile looked up from the playing board, which was in fact the world.
"All right, who doth he belong to?" he lisped. "We've got a clever one here."
There was a general craning of necks among the assembled deities, and then one put up his hand.
"And you are?"
"The Almighty Nuggan. I'm worshipped in parts of Borogravia. The young man was raised in my faith."
"What do Nugganites believe in?"
"Me. Mostly me. And followers are forbidden to eat chocolate, ginger, mushrooms and garlic."
Several of the gods winced.
"When you prohibit, you don't meth about, do you?"
said Offler.
"No sense in forbidding broccoli, is there? That sort of approach is very old-fashioned,"
said Nuggan. He looked at the minstrel.
"He's never been particularly bright up till now. Shall I smite him? There's bound to be some garlic in that stew. Mrs. McGarry looks the type."
Offler hesitated. He was a very old god who had arisen from steaming swamps in hot, dark lands. He had survived the rise and fall of more modern and certainly more beautiful gods by developing, for a god, a certain amount of wisdom. Besides, Nuggan was one of the newer gods, all full of hellfire and self-importance and ambition. Offler was not bright, but he had some vague inkling that for long-term survival, gods needed to offer their worshippers something more than a mere lack of thunderbolts. And he felt an ungodlike pang of sympathy for any human whose god banned chocolate and garlic. Anyway, Nuggan had an unpleasant moustache. No god had any business with a fussy little moustache like that.
"No,"
he said, shaking the dice box,
"it'll add to the fun."
Cohen pinched out the end of his ragged cigarette, stuffed it behind his ear, and looked up at the green ice.
"It's not too late to turn back," said Evil Harry. "If anyone wanted to, I mean."
"Yes, it is," said Cohen, without looking round. "Besides, someone's not playing fair."
"Funny, really," said Vina. "All my life I've done adventuring with old maps, found in old tombs and so on, and I never ever worried about where they came from. It's one of those things you never think about. Like who leaves all the weapons and keys and medicine kits lying around in the unexplored dungeons?"
"Someone be setting a trap," said Boy Willie.
"Probably. Won't be the first trap I've walked into," said Cohen.
"We're going up against the gods, Cohen," said Harry. "A man does that, a man's got to be sure of his luck."
"Mine's worked up to now," said Cohen.
He reached out and touched the rock face in front of him.
"It's warm."
"But it's got ice on," said Harry.
"Yeah. Strange, eh?" said Cohen. "It's just like the scroll said. And see the way the snows stick into it? It's the magic. Well, here goes."
An extract from the Journal of Leonard de Quirm, Testing the Handiwork of the Gods. "It being apparent that a voyage into the great void will result in much stress upon the human frame, I have devised this device of three rings that rotate continuously in three planes, giving the voyager the feeling of being rotated continuously in three planes. It is vital to know if the human body, or at least that of the wizard Rincewind, can withstand such treatment." Extract the second, The Circulation of the Vomit. "The wizard Rincewind reports a feeling of lightness occasioned by his stomach contents leaving his body and the wax running out of his ears. Prolonged tumbling on the device causes him to experience the feeling of wishing to kill everyone, beginning, against all common sense, with himself. He also issues screams and threats. From this I deduce that being tumbled in three directions at once has a deleterious effect, and I will arrange for this not to happen on the voyage.
the musculature of the wizard Rincewind would make an interesting study if, indeed, he had any.
Arch-Chancellor Ridcully decided that the crew needed to be trained. Ponder Stibbons pointed out that they were going into the completely unexpected, and Ridcully ruled, therefore, that they should be given some unexpected training. Rincewind, on the other hand, said that they were heading for certain death, which everyone managed eventually with no training whatsoever. Later, he said that Leonard's device would do, though. After 5 minutes on it, certain death seemed like a release.
"He's thrown up again,"
said the Dean.
"He's getting better at it, though," said the Chair of Indefinite Studies.
"How can you say that? Last time it was a whole 10 seconds before he let go."
"Yes, but he's throwing up more and it's going further," said the chair as they strolled away.
The Dean looked up. It was hard to see the flying device in the shadows of the tarpaulin-covered barge. Sheets were spread over the more interesting bits. There were strong smells of glue and varnish. The librarian, who tended to get involved in things, was hanging peacefully from a spar and hammering wooden pegs into a plank.
"It'll be balloons, you mark my word," said the Dean.
"I've got a mental picture. Balloons and sails and rigging and so on. Probably an anchor, too. Fanciful stuff."
"Over in the Agatian Empire, they have kites big enough to carry men," said the Chair.
"Perhaps he's just building a bigger kite, then."
In the distance, Leonard of Querm was sitting in a pool of light, sketching. Occasionally, he'd hand a page to a waiting apprentice, who would hurry away.
"Did you see the design he came up with yesterday?"
The Dean
had this idea that they might have to get outside the machine to repair it. So he designed a sort of device to let you fly round with a dragon on your back. Said it was for emergencies."
"What kind of emergency would be worse than having a dragon strapped to your back?"
said the Chair of Indefinite Studies.
"Exactly. The man lives in an ivory tower."
"Does he? I thought Vetinari had him locked up in some attic."
"Well, I mean, years of that is going to give a man a very limited vision, in my humble opinion. Nothing much to do but tick the days off on the wall."
"They say he paints good pictures," said the Chair.
"Well, pictures,"
said the Dean dismissively.
"But they say his are so good the eyes follow you round the room."
"Really? What does the rest of the face do?"
"That stays where it is, I suppose," said the Chair of Indefinite Studies.
"To me, this does not sound good,"
said the Dean as they wandered out into the daylight. At his desk, while considering the problem of steering a craft in thin air, Leonard carefully drew a rose. Evil Harry shut his eyes.
"This does not feel good," he said.
"It's easy when you get used to it," said Cohen. "It's just a matter of how you look at things."
Evil Harry opened his eyes again. He was standing on a broad, greenish plain, which curved down gently to right and left. It was like being on a high, grassy ridge. It stretched off into a cloudy distance.
"It's just a stroll," said Boy Willie beside him.
"Look, my feet aren't the problem here," said Evil Harry. "My feet aren't quarrelling, it's my brain."
"It helps if you think of the ground as being behind you," said Boy Willie.
"No," said Evil Harry, "it doesn't."
The strange feature of the mountain was this. Once a foot was set on it, direction became a matter of personal choice. To put it another way, gravity was optional. It stayed under your feet, no matter which way your feet were pointing. Evil Harry wondered why it was affecting only him. The horde seemed entirely unmoved. Even Mad Hamish's horrible wheelchair was bowling along happily in a direction which, up until now, Harry had thought of as vertical. It was, he thought, probably because evil lords were generally brighter than heroes. You needed some functioning brain cells to do the payroll even for half a dozen henchmen. And Evil Harry's brain cells were telling him to look straight ahead and try to believe that he was strolling along a broad, happy ridge, and on no account to turn around, to even think about turning around, because behind him was
"Steady on," said Boy Willie, steadying his arm. "Listen to your feet. They know what they're about."
To Harry's horror, Cohen chose this moment to turn around.
"Will you look at that view?" he said. "I can see everybody's house from up here."
"No. Oh, no. Please, no," mumbled Evil Harry, flinging himself forward and holding on to the mountain.
"'It's great, isn't it?' said Truckle. "'Seeing all them seas sort of hanging right over you like,
"'What's up with Harry?'
"'Just a bit poorly,' said Vina. To Cohen's surprise, the minstrel seemed quite at home with the view.
"'They come from up in the mountains,' he explained. "'You get a head for heights up there.'
"'I've been to everywhere I can see,' said Cohen, looking around. "'Been there, done that. Been there again, done it twice. Nowhere left where I ain't been.'
The minstrel looked him up and down, and a kind of understanding dawned. "'I know why you are doing this now,' he thought. "'Thank goodness for a classical education. Now, what was the quote?'
"'And Carolinus wept, for there were no more worlds to conquer,' he said.
"'Who's that bloke? You mentioned him before,' said Cohen.
"'You haven't heard of the Emperor Carolinus?'
"'Nope.
But he was the greatest conqueror that ever lived. His empire spanned the entire disk, except for the counterweight continent and 4X, of course.
I don't blame him. You can't get a good beer in one of them for love nor money, and the other's a bugger to get to.
Well, when he got as far as the coast of Muntab, it was said that he stood on the shore and wept. Some philosopher told him there were more worlds out there somewhere, and that he'd never be able to conquer them. That reminded me a bit of you.
Cohen strolled along in silence for a moment.
"'Yeah,' he said at last. "'Yeah, I could see how it could be. Only not a sissy, obviously.'
"'It is now,' said Ponder Stibbons. "'T minus 12 hours.'
His audience, sitting on the deck, watched him with alert and polite incomprehension.
"'That means the flying machine will go over the edge just before dawn tomorrow,' Ponder explained.
Everyone turned to Leonard, who was watching a seagull.
"'Mr. De Quirm,' said Lord Vetinari.
"'What? Oh, yes,' Leonard blinked. "'Yes, the device will be ready, although the privy is giving me problems.'
The lecturer in recent runes fumbled in the capacious pockets of his robes.
"'Oh, dear, I believe I have a bottle of something. The sea always affects me that way, too.'
"'I'm just rather thinking of problems associated with the thin air and low gravity,' said Leonard. "'That's what the survivor of the Maria Pesto reported. "'But this afternoon I feel I can come up with a privy that happily utilizes the thinner air of altitude to achieve the effect normally associated with gravity. "'Gentle suction is involved,'
Ponder nodded. He had a quick mind when it came to mechanical detail, and he'd already formed a mental picture. Now a mental eraser would be useful.
Good, he said. Well, most of the ships will fall behind the barge during the night. Even with magically assisted wind, we dare not venture closer than 30 miles to the rim. After that, we could be caught in the current and swept over the edge.
Rincewind, who had been leaning moodily over the rail and watching the water, turned at this.
"'How far are we from the island of Krull?' he said. "'That place? Hundreds of miles,' said Ponder. "'We want to keep well away from those pirates.'
"'So we'll run straight into the circumfence, then?'
There was technically silence, although it was loud with unspoken thoughts. Each man was busy trying to think of a reason why it would have been far too much to expect him to have thought of this, while at the same time being a reason why someone else should have. The circumfence was the biggest construction ever built. It extended almost a third of the way around the world. On the large island of Krull, an entire civilization lived on what they recovered from it. They ate a lot of sushi, and their dislike for the rest of the world was put down to permanent dyspepsia. In his chair, Lord Vetinari grinned in a thin, acid way.
"'Yes, indeed,' he said. "'It extends for several thousands of miles, I understand.' However, I gather the Krullians no longer keep captive seamen as slaves. They simply charge ruinous salvage rates.
A few fireballs would blow the thing apart, said Ridcully.
That does rather require you to be very close to it, though, said Lord Vetinari. That is to say, so close to the rim fall that you would be destroying the very thing that is preventing you from being swept over the edge. "'A knotty problem, gentlemen.'
"'Magic carpet,' said Ridcully. "'Just the job. We've got one in.'
"'Not that close to the edge, sir,'
said Ponder dismally. "The thaumic field is very thin, and there are some ferocious air currents." There was the crisp rattle of a big drawing pad being turned to the next page.
"Oh, yes," said Leonard, more or less to himself.
"Pardon me," said the patrician.
"I did once design a simple means whereby entire fleets could be destroyed quite easily, my lord, only as a technical exercise, of course."
"But with numbered parts and a list of instructions," said the patrician.
"Why, yes, my lord, of course. Otherwise, it would not be a proper exercise. And I feel sure that with the help of these magical gentlemen, we should be able to adapt it for this purpose."
He gave them a bright smile. They looked at his drawing. Men were leaping from ships in flames into a boiling sea.
"You do this sort of thing as a hobby, do you?" said the dean.
"Oh, yes. There are no practical applications."
"But couldn't someone build something like that?" said the lecturer in recent runes. "You practically include glue and transfers."
"Well, I dare say there are people like that," said Leonard diffidently, "but I'm sure the government would put a stop to things before they went too far."
And the smile on Lord Vetinari's face was one that probably even Leonard of Quirm, with all his genius, would never be able to capture on canvas. Very carefully, knowing that if they dropped one they probably wouldn't even know they'd dropped one, a team of students and apprentices lifted the cages of dragons into the racks under the rear of the flying machine. Occasionally, one of the dragons hiccuped. Everyone present, bar one, would freeze. The exception was Rincewind, who would be crouched down behind a pile of timber many yards away. "They've all been well fed on Leonard's special feed and should be quite docile for 4 or 5 hours," said Ponder, pulling him out for the third time. "The first two stages were given their meals with a carefully timed interval, and the first lot should be in a mood to flame just as you go over the rimfall."
"But what if we're delayed?"
Ponder gave this some deep thought.
"Whatever you do, don't be delayed," he said.
"Thank you."
"Now, the ones that you'll be taking with you in flight may need feeding too. We've loaded a mixture of naphtha, rock oil, and anthracite dust."
"For me to feed to the dragons?"
"Yes."
"In this wooden ship, which will be very, very high?"
"Well, in a technical sense, yes."
"Could we focus on that technicality?"
"Strictly speaking, there won't be any down as such. You could say that you will be travelling so fast that you won't be in any one place long enough to fall down."
Ponder sought a glimmer of understanding in Rincewind's face.
"Or, to put it another way, you'll be falling permanently without ever hitting the ground."
Up above them, rack on rack of dragons sizzled contentedly. Wisps of steam drifted through the shadows.
"Oh," said Rincewind.
"You understand?" said Ponder.
"No. I was just hoping that if I didn't say anything, you'd stop trying to explain things to me."
"How are we doing, Mr. Stibbons?" said the Arch-Chancellor, strolling up at the head of his wizards. "How's our enormous kite?"
"Everything's going to plan, sir. We're at T-minus 5 hours, sir."
"Really? Good. We're at supper in 10 minutes.
Rincewind had a small cabin with cold water and running rats. Most of it that wasn't occupied by his bunk was occupied by his luggage. The luggage. It was a box that walked around on hundreds of little legs. It was magical, as far as he knew. He'd had it for years. It understood every word he said. It obeyed about 1 in every 100, unfortunately.
"There won't be any room," he said, "and you know every time you've gone up in the air you've got lost."
The luggage watched him in its eyeless way. "So you stay with nice Mr. Stibbons, all right? You've never been at ease around gods either. I shall be back very soon." Still the eyeless stare went on.
"Just don't look at me that way, will you?" said Rincewind.
Lord Vetinari cast his eye over the three... what was the word?
"Men,"
he said, settling for one that was undoubtedly correct. "It falls to me to congratulate you on... He hesitated. Lord Vetinari was not a man who delighted in the technical. There were two cultures, as far as he was concerned. One was the real one. The other was occupied by people who liked machinery and ate pizza at unreasonable hours.
on being the first people to leave the disk with the resolute intention of returning to it," he went on. "Your mission is to land on or near Cori Celesti, locate Cohen the Barbarian and his men, and by whatever means feasible stop this ridiculous scheme of theirs. There must be some misunderstanding. Even barbarian heroes generally draw the line at blowing up the world," he sighed. "They're usually not civilized enough for that," he added. "Anyway, we implore him to listen to reason, etc. Barbarians are generally sentimentalists. Tell him about all the dear little puppies that we killed or something. Beyond that, I can't advise you further. I suspect classical force is out of the question. If Cohen was easy to kill, people would have done it a long time ago." Captain Carrot saluted. "Force is always the last resort, sir," he said. "I believe that for Cohen it's the first choice," said Lord Vetinari. "He's not too bad if you don't come up behind him suddenly," said Rincewind. "Ah, there is the voice of our mission specialist," said the patrician. "I just hope... What is that on your badge, Captain Carrot?"
"Mission motto, sir," said Carrot cheerfully. "Moritori nolumus mori. Rincewind suggested it."
"I imagine he did," said Lord Vetinari, observing the wizard coldly. "And would you care to give us a colloquial translation, Mr. Rincewind?" Rincewind hesitated, but there was really no escape.
Roughly speaking, it means we who are about to die don't want to, sir."
"Very clearly expressed, I commend your determination. Yes?" Ponder had whispered something in his ear.
"Ah, I'm informed that we have to leave you shortly," said Lord Vetinari. "Mr. Stibbons tells me that there is a means of keeping in touch with you, at least until you're close to the mountain."
"Yes, sir," said Carrot. "The fractured omniscope. An amazing device. Each part sees what the other part sees. Astonishing."
"Well, I trust your new careers will be uplifting, if not meteoric. To your places, gentlemen."
I just want to take an iconograph, sir," said Ponder, hurrying forward and clutching a large box, "to record the moment. If you would all stand in front of the flag and smile, please. That means the corners of your mouth go up, Rincewind. Thank you." Ponder, like all bad photographers, took the shot just a fraction of a second after the smiles had frozen.
"And do you have any last words?"
"Do you mean last words before we go and come back?" said Carrot, his brow wrinkling.
"Oh, yes, of course, that's what I meant. Because, of course, you will be coming back, won't you?"
said Ponder, far too quickly, in Rincewind's opinion.
"I have absolute confidence in Mr. De Querm's work, and I'm sure he has too."
"Oh, dear. No, I never bothered to have any confidence," said Leonard.
"You don't?"
"No, things just work. You don't have to wish," said Leonard.
"And, of course, if we do fail, then things won't be that bad, will they? If we fail to come back, there won't be anywhere left to fail to come back to in any case, will there? So it will all cancel out."
He gave his happy little smile. "Logic is a great comfort in times like this, I always find."
"Personally," said Captain Carrot, "I am happy, thrilled, and delighted to be going."
He tapped a box by his side.
"And I am, as instructed, also bringing along an iconograph, and intend to take many useful and deeply moving images of our world from the perspective of space, which will perhaps cause us to see humanity an entirely new light."
Is this the time to resign from the crew?" said Rincewind, staring at his fellow voyagers.
"No," said Lord Vetinari.
Possibly on grounds of insanity.
"Your own, I assume?"
"Take your pick."
Vetinari beckoned Rincewind forward.
"But it could be said that someone would have to be insane to take part in this venture," he murmured. "In which case, of course, you are fully qualified."
"Then, supposing I'm not insane?"
"Oh, as ruler of Ankh-Morpork, I have a duty to send only the keenest, coolest minds on a vital errand of this kind."
He held Rincewind's gaze for a moment.
"I think there's a catch there," said the wizard, knowing that he'd lost.
"Yes, the best kind there is," said the patrician.